Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Maureen Smith.
And I'm Joshua Lewis Smith.
And we are joined today with Allison Grauer, author, actor, ukulele player.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things. You're kind of a Renaissance lady.
Well, I do work at the Renaissance Fair.
So it is appropriate.
It's applicable.
And expected.
Yes. I'm contractually obligated to do too many things.
Right.
Well, and I think that you've been pretty successful at that.
So far, yeah. It's been going pretty good. So, as usual, we're having an adorable animal moment of Moody knocking a thing around.
Discovering a bottle cap.
One second. It's some action work. It's
now,
acting.
Yeah, you can imagine that while we've been setting up the audio, Moody has been sitting on a chair like a complete princess, and we hit record.
She found a bottle cap.
But it's too adorable to stop recording.
It really is.
She stopped. So, elephant in the room, Daniel is not with us today. He is actually at a gig. But Josh has been kind enough to stand in for him, and it'll be business as usual.
Yeah.
Except with everybody talking at a higher pitch.
Yeah.
Daniel
We've got a lot
has
of trouble going on
Daniel
today.
Has, like, one of the lowest voices.
Really?
It's like, I'm Daniel Johansson.
I could not even try. And I'm Daniel.
So anyway, I brought you on because, well, first of all, I've known you for 13 years.
Is it 13?
Something like that. I've known you since I was in 8th grade.
Yep.
Yes. So that was 2003.
Uh-huh.
14 years.
Yeah, that sounds about right, actually.
Yeah. A little background. We were both in a youth Irish choir. We traveled to Ireland.
Together. Many shenanigans were
hand
had.
In hand.
Yes. We actually sat in the back of the tour bus one night, listening to opera on our iPods and weeping.
Yeah.
Oh.
Were we listening to Maria Callas singing
yes.
O Mio Babbino Caro?
Yes, it was Maria Callas.
Which is not even a sad
story. Yeah. No, it was just too good. And then we switched to Tosca,
mm-hmm.
because I love Tosca. It's my favorite.
Yeah.
And then we switched to something else.
Yeah.
Probably Carmen.
Probably.
Good choices.
It was a good time.
Yeah.
But that's not why we were in Ireland. We were there to sing.
Yeah.
With the choir.
And sing we did. We
yes.
also did a bunch of theater together.
Yeah.
We were in a wildly inappropriate for our age production of Company.
Yes. And it remains to this day one of my most treasured theatrical experiences. Because no lie, it was absolutely inappropriate for our age,
yeah.
for most of our types,
yeah,
and yet, sure. and yet, there were some genuine moments of really good acting in that show.
We killed it!
We nailed that
show. It was
show.
So good!
Fun story, I guess, if this is about me throwing what little ego I have around. Getting married today, because
mm-hmm.
I played Amy in the production.
Oh, this is my favorite character.
I do. I played Amy, and we took a video of the show, because
yeah.
we needed it,
mm-hmm.
obviously. And I put once we had the video accessible, I put my Getting Married Today on YouTube, and currently, at the time of this recording, it has, like, a metric buttload of views.
That's
like,
so cool.
A ton of views. Like, if you search Getting Married Today, mine will come up on the first or second page.
Really?
Wow.
And people still, to this day, like, I'll get emails from YouTube, like, someone commented on Getting Married Today. I'm like, why? And then I go, and it's got all these comments, like, this is the best one on YouTube, she's the best non-professional one I've ever seen,
wow.
she's better than the Broadway recording, da-da-da-da-da.
That's
like,
amazing.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So, like, every time I forget that I had a musical theater career for a hot minute,
yeah.
I go back and I'm like, oh, yes, the best on YouTube.
That's amazing.
That's
no,
my one little thing.
Well, and every once in a while, it'll come up on, like, everybody's, you know, on this day. And we're all fantasizing about the day that that we all turn 35 so that we can have a reunion.
So we can have our actual phone rings, door chimes, here comes company party.
So, Maureen, who did you play?
I was Susan. So okay. I did the bless this day. Of course you're okay. Okay.
Obviously, right?
Yeah, of course.
I did that. And
you also had really sassy eyebrows in the background during that song. Like, if you go back and watch it, you're, like, really condescending. It's amazing. It's super good.
Maureen Smith, secretly condescending since secretly. 2000.
Openly well, condescending. Okay.
Yeah. All right. no, but, and my character was also the one whose husband, they're excited about getting a divorce.
Yeah, okay.
Because yes. her husband is gay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
which story of my life?
Ooh, strangely prophetic.
That's okay. My track record is broken now.
Yeah.
So, let's get into it.
Sure.
So, we brought you on because you're kicking ass right now.
Thank you.
I feel like a lot of times when I see you post, it's like, I have this project coming up, and you're constantly doing photo shoots, and, like, you published a novel.
I did.
And so, first let's talk about the novel.
Okay.
Because that's incredible to me that you, like, did the thing.
Thank you.
And you have it out there. So, I mean, can you talk to me, like, a little bit about the process?
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, as long as you've known me, mm-hmm. I'm sure you knew that I was a writer. Mm-hmm. And I was constantly writing things and working on stories and, you know, dreaming up new ideas and filling notebooks during class and that whole mm-hmm. thing. So I always knew that I wanted to write. I always knew that I wanted to share that writing with the world and, like, get published and be an author. I always knew that. I wrote all through high school and all through college, and then I kind of took a break right at the end of college, because everybody should take a break from their real hobbies at the end of college to get through college.
Yeah.
And then when I got out on the other side, I was like, okay, now it's time for me to learn short stories. So
okay.
What I did is I read a lot of short stories in different genres, different anthologies, picked up magazines, that kind of thing, and I investigated different opportunities and contests and things like that I could submit to learn more about the craft, basically, mm-hmm. and to, like, get that experience. And I wrote things and I got rejected, and that was cool, and I felt really good about it. And then a short story of mine was accepted for an anthology by a small independent press called Skylar Publishing. And they were like, this is really great. We really like this. We'd love to put this in the anthology. And I was like, great. It's a novella. It's a short story about, it's called Lavenza, or the Modern Galatea, and it's basically Frankenstein, but from his fiancé's point of view.
Okay.
Cool.
In a steampunky kind of setting.
Sure.
But, I mean, it didn't take a whole lot to push that into that genre, because Frankenstein is incredibly steampunk.
Yeah.
On
oh,
its own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wrote that, and it came out a couple months after I signed that contract. I was super excited. And then I thought, okay, back to the drawing board. And then they sent me an email and they were like, we really liked working with you and we really like your style. Do you have any novels?
That's amazing.
And I was like, okay, first of all, that's not how novels get published. There's got to be a catch.
Right.
Like, what is it? And there really wasn't a catch. They just really liked what I did. And they were like, we'd love to do something. Send us some proposals. And so I did. The November before, I had done National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo.
Mm-hmm.
Which I recommend for anybody, not just novelists, but any artist should experience it.
I love, every November, I'm always blown away at how many of my friends actually do it.
So many,
yes.
And people I didn't even know were writers, or they
yeah.
don't have to be, like
yeah.
you said.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
People come
yeah.
out of the woodwork to give it a shot, and it's really, you learn so much about yourself, and you learn so much about how to build that thing that you think is impossible. The November before the short story had come out, I had done a novel for NaNoWriMo, and I kind of liked it. It wasn't really done, but I kind of liked the idea, and I was kind of into that idea at the time, and was like, well, I have this thing, and I pitched it to them with an outline and a synopsis, and they were like, yeah, this is great, we're sending you a contract, and I was
okay.
like, oh, okay. And there was no advance or anything.
Yeah.
It's a small indie micro press,
oh, yeah.
of which there are many now,
mm-hmm.
But it felt really cool to have this thing suddenly thrown into action. And then I spent the next year and a half almost 2 years rewriting and editing.
Yeah.
And working with a whole team of people who were, like, they made me a book trailer, and they, like, put stuff out on the internet.
That's amazing.
And it's a cool book trailer.
It is.
Yeah,
like, I'll post it on our Facebook.
Good.
Yeah. And then it just kind of, it all came together. It was a lot of work rewriting and, like, following deadlines for the first time. Polishing it. And I went in with a very open mind, and I was ready to say yes to pretty much everything, including, like, you know how they say, like, kill your darlings or whatever? Like,
yeah.
Whatever edits they wanted me to make, I pretty much made them. There were only a few things that I was like, we need to talk about this one because of this and this and this. And so there were a couple of things that I pushed back on, but not many. And I think, honestly, it was better for it because I went in ready to, like, learn and have it be a growing process.
I think that's such a good attitude to go into any art making.
Yeah.
Applicable to most things in life, really.
Definitely.
Not
definitely.
Just art, even. Yeah.
Especially when you're doing something like that for the first time,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, because, you know, whether or not they know better is not the point. The point is that you get to build it for the first time,
yeah,
and to figure that out. So the book is called On the Isle of Sound and Wonder, and it is a fantasy steampunk retelling of William Shakespeare's The Tempest.
Oh, cool.
No,
I really like that.
It's very near and dear to my heart, obviously. It's my first book, and some people go out in the world and become writers, and they're like, ooh, I'm never going to tell you the name of my first book because I don't want you to read it.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like Sound and Wonder. I really like the characters. There's a couple characters that I like more than the other characters, but it was fun, and even though it was really hard and challenging and it really pushed me, it was a good start. It was a very good start for me. And the last couple of years, that came out in 2014, and so the last couple of years since then, I've been working on other projects and building other things, getting ready for continuing that career.
So now that you went into the first book with kind of like an open mind and like feeling very open to comments and edits and with the idea of minimal pushback.
Yeah.
Are you going to go into your second with more of a firm hand, or did you like the process of being more open?
That's a good question. I honestly think that when a piece is at a certain point, it should definitely be not torn to shreds, but like it should definitely be broken apart and put back together again like Legos, right?
Yeah.
So that it will be stronger and bigger and more
of
amazing.
Course.
It's hard to see that right now because I have a couple of things that I'm writing right now. I have like two like half novels kind of in the mix, and I have a whole world built for something else that hasn't even happened yet. Because I keep trying to start it, and it keeps not working, and I'm not sure why.
Mm.
So it's been a tough couple of years since then for me, trying to figure out what I'm doing and how I'm going to do it. So at this point, I'm very open to learning new things and to figure out the next steps. And I think right now for me, the struggle is getting back to that place where I'm comfortable drafting freely. Like, where I'm comfortable just writing for the sake of writing and enjoying it.
Sure.
And not cutting myself apart because I know it's going to come. Like,
right.
With Sound and Wonder, I had no idea anyone was going to edit it, so I just wrote whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. And then editing it was its own process. But now I'm struggling with, I guess, like a sophomore slump of not trying really hard not to edit myself in the draft, which is very difficult
for
me.
Yeah. As it reminds me, this is slightly tangential but super related, is that you guys know Alison Krauss, the bluegrass musician.
Yeah,
yeah.
So she recently released her first studio album in like 10 years or something,
yeah.
Even though she's been very active. I think she actually has the most Grammy wins of any female singer.
Good for her.
Ever.
Yeah.
But so she finally released this new CD, and they came out with a bunch of articles about it. And I think it was in the Times interview with her where she was like, it took forever to record this because I had this self-editing voice, and she went to a vocal coach and this and that, and in the end she learned, she's like, oh, I just have to do it.
Yeah.
Like, and
yeah.
Take out that critical ear,
mm-hmm.
because this is what I'm good at.
Yeah.
And that reminds me so much of that, but also because, of course, the editing will come.
Yeah.
So if you're sitting there editing forever while you're writing, you're never going to write.
Yeah, and I know that I'm not alone in that. I know that there's a lot of writers who fall into that same
pattern.
Where all they do is draft their whole lives, and then they're like reluctant to call themselves writers because they don't do anything with it because they're constantly editing.
Right.
And I think that's true for a lot of different art mediums, that people will self-criticize and self-edit, or maybe someone close to them is there giving them that critique and that, trying to nudge them towards their success, but instead it comes back down as that self-perpetuating.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and I, the point is, it that happens in every art form.
Yeah.
Like, being, like, Josh and I both being singers, like, it's so hard, you know, once you learn something, because everything you sing, unless it's brand new, has such a lineage.
Yeah. Especially with opera.
Yeah.
God, yeah.
Because there's such a rich history of, like, whatever, like, being a soprano, whatever I sing, Maria Callas has sung.
Yeah.
Whatever I sing, Joan Sutherland has sung. You know,
right.
What, and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
It's like there's a hesitance to bring it forward, you know, lest you be, you know, one of these, you know,
these legends. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think one of the hard things. One of the hardest things about art is that you know that should you continue on your trajectory, you'll be better next year,
yeah.
And then you'll be better the year after that. So when do you just do it?
Yeah.
And when do you stop waiting?
Yes.
And I think that that's applicable to, I mean, I've mentioned on the podcast before that my father's a painter, and so he's 70 and he's still doing that, you know? And but I think that's definitely applicable to writing, and it's, of course, applicable to singing, because sometimes you have to just stop and go, I'm never going to be an artist if I don't just do my art.
Yeah.
I'm never going to be a singer if I just keep waiting and practicing. I have to just go out and sing. And what I have right now is good, and maybe it'll be better next year, but that's okay.
Yeah.
That's good. That's
yeah.
great.
So I have a question. So
yeah.
In singing, there are organizations and opera companies that
mm-hmm.
kind of provide, like, kind of in the vein of like an open mic, but like for instance, Milwaukee Opera Theater has a thing called Voice Lab,
mm.
where you go up and you can sing something, you know, you can sing a piece that you're working on and ask for feedback from
cool.
your peers.
Yeah,
I guess what I, and it's like an, I mean, of course, because we're people, there's going to be judgment, but I mean, it's
for sure.
The intention is that it's a safe space. I'm wondering, is there a space like that for writers, or is it just the internet?
I think from what my experience has been and from what I've observed through other people, the internet is, as we all know, a dangerous and wonderful place.
Yeah.
And
yes.
There is something for everybody out there. And you can find the people who will be good for you creatively. You can also find the people who will be bad for you creatively.
Yeah.
Right.
So from what I understand, it's a lot about people building their own kind of tribe
mm-hmm.
situation. There are some authors that I follow on Twitter that have become kind of like, I don't know, like, northern stars for me.
Okay.
Like, if they post something, I read it.
Sure.
And if they blog something, I read it. And I take note of what they've published, and I read what they've published. Because I value their opinions, I value who they are as a person, and I value their art. And then that sort of helps me continue developing what I'm
mm-hmm.
working on. So, for me, it's that. And then only recently have I really settled down with two specific people who are also writers whose opinions I value that
okay.
I know who are going to be my actual critique partners. And some people, there are websites where you can go on and find critique groups and find forums where you can post your stuff and get feedback and learn. And there's classes you can take online. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say that, yeah, there's definitely spaces for that.
Right.
It's more about finding what works for you.
Yeah, because we definitely had that in, like, writing classes in college, but of
sure.
course you're going to have that, where you share and you
mm-hmm.
give each other that feedback. So I know that kind of space existed there.
Yeah.
And I assume there's, of course, places for that
yeah.
outside of school.
I think it's more about finding what works for you personally. And for me, I knew that I didn't want to go to a forum and find anonymous people that I don't know
sure.
to give me feedback. Like,
yeah.
That's not how I wanted to do it. I wanted a sense of that, that grounding in knowing who someone is. So there are, like, famous-ish writers that I follow, like I said, on social media, whose blogs I value and whose actual fiction I value. And, you know, they're New York Times bestsellers, so whatever.
Casual.
And then I have two friends now, Tegan and Katie, who are both exceptional writers on their own, and who have agreed, who came to me and agreed to sort of share this critique balance with each other.
That's wonderful.
Which is great. And so I'm looking forward to really delving into that over the next year.
So if you don't mind me asking, who are some of your New York Times writer favorites?
Yeah, I recommend wholeheartedly, without any reservation,
yeah.
Neil Gaiman. You know, Lord of all that is holy. I also recommend Chuck Wendig, who is a genius, but he's also a big old weirdo. Like, his social media is crazy.
Okay.
Like, half of his Twitter is stuff that his four-year-old son says.
Love it.
And the other half is, like, weird choose-your-own-adventure polls where, like, nothing makes any sense. He's crazy, and he's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, his work is amazing. He's also one of the guys who has been thrown into being in charge of the new Star Wars fiction universe.
Oh.
So, like, you know how they took out...
Yeah,
the
whole expanded universe,
they axed the extended universe, more or less, and then they were like, alright, we're gonna build a new extended universe.
Right.
Chuck Wendig is kind of the guy who's in charge.
Oh, okay, okay.
Not in charge of it, I mean, I don't know, maybe he is in charge of it, but he's writing the big novels about the current Star Wars universe.
Right.
And then Delilah S. Dawson is amazing. She writes a whole spectrum of things, which inspires me to know that, you know, you don't have to just pick a genre and stay there forever.
Yeah.
She has written fun, heavily world-built fantasy romances.
Okay.
She's written crazy erotica. She's written some young adult dystopian stuff, but not with the love triangle. Just, like, hard dystopian.
Yeah.
She's written one of her more recent trilogies that's sort of in progress. The first book is called Wake of Vultures, and it's about a bisexual, half-black, half-Native American, like, gender-fluid girl who becomes a monster hunter in the Wild West.
That,
like, right?
Awesome.
Don't you just...
I'm super into this.
Which at first I was like, okay, all right, this better be good, because that's a really high... That's a really tall Starbucks order, right?
Yeah.
Like, but it's amazing. Like, it's really good. Delilah is amazing. And
that's so
important. Like, I adore what she does. And she is constantly doing new stuff. And she's constantly coming up with something new and something that's, like, relevant but also fantastical, which is so important right now, I think.
Yeah, and that's... I brought it up in our questionable internet opinion that we recorded yesterday, because we were talking about queer representation.
Yeah.
Because for me, just as a gay person, it's so important.
Mm-hmm.
But then I grew up, like you, fantasy and sci-fi were my things. And I still, to this day, read fantasy novels nonstop. But of course, when I was growing up, there were not a lot of queer characters. And you're starting to find them more and more now.
Yeah.
Of course, the trick is, you're like, ooh, this sounds good as a gay character, and then it just turns out to be, like, hardcore erotic, and you're like, this isn't what
you're
I signed up for. That's
fine,
but not what I was looking for right now.
If that's what you like, that's fine.
But,
and there's some good erotica out there, gonna lie.
No, of course, it's kind of it's an art form in itself,
it is.
Making it good. And
Right, and like, actually have substance, and not like, here's your pizza. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
But it's so nice to hear that people are really putting out stuff of substance and well done that also contains some representation, and I love that.
Definitely.
No, that's awesome. And I'm just gonna you know, pivot really quick.
Let's do it.
I wanna talk to you about Disney.
Yes, let's do it.
Because and this is something that I'm noticing, you're one of the many people in my network of people who hold Disney so, like, close to their heart, and you're kind of, like, taking a step, you know, even more so in that direction. Like, when you were walking, you know, we have the noisiest heater in the world. I'm so sorry.
Welcome to Chicago.
Yeah.
it's okay. I just get startled.
Yeah, if you, at the end of the show, I'm gonna ask for donations, mainly so that we can improve our audio setup, which I do at the end, but of every episode.
Do you guys have a Patreon?
We have a PayPal button.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Direct.
So, and Daniel gets a pop-up notification on his phone when it's like, you have money. And I'm like, oh.
Yay! Confetti falls from the ceiling.
Yeah, exactly. Moody runs around the apartment. No, on the way into the apartment, we were talking, and you described it as you and Drew, your husband, wanting to be Disney scholars, or amateur Disney scholars.
Yes. So, like, I've always loved Disney. Many people, as you mentioned, in our age bracket, really, have a very strong, like, personal, like, deeply rooted thing for Disney.
It's true.
and I can speak about why I think that is, but I, to sort of explain, when my husband and I started dating,
mm-hmm.
we thought it would be fun to start over at the beginning and watch all of the Walt Disney Animation Studios animated feature films in
yeah.
chronological order, starting with Snow White, which was the first one,
yeah.
and going all the way to the present day, which at the time was Big Hero 6, because that had just come out when we started. So we were like, it'll be like mandatory date night, and we'll learn about Disney while we do it. And then I thought, well, why don't I blog it while we're doing it? I'm sure no one's had this idea before. And of course, someone has. There's like 12 people. If
of
you,
course.
But right. like in different formats. Some people do it with every Disney movie ever made. Some people do it with Disney and Pixar. We decided just to do Walt Disney Animation Studios.
Got it.
So you know there's different studios
yeah.
within the Disney company. so we're not doing any of the Pixar ones yet.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do like another one later for the Pixar ones.
Okay.
So starting with Snow White, and now currently the last one will be Moana, because that is the most current Walt Disney Animation Studios
yeah.
feature film. And obviously the direct-to-VHS sequels don't count.
Okay.
They don't count.
Because they don't.
No Return.
Like in the world.
No, they never count.
I mean, like, I feel like Return of Jafar might have played a little bit of a role in my life. That's the only one.
Wasn't there a Lion King 1.5?
Yes. It's about Timon and Pumbaa.
Oh.
I'm kind of okay with that.
It's also about Scar's son.
Did the original voice
Scar
actors return
son?
For that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and say no.
I just want to ask about Scar's son.
His name is Kovu. And he falls in love with Kiara, who is Simba's daughter.
Oh,
so instead of Hamlet, it's Romeo and Juliet?
Bingo!
Hey!
Hey!
Hey! So we thought it would be a good idea to sort of start at the beginning and see what we could gather, see what we could learn by watching it in chronological order. And many of the movies, obviously, we've seen already, but there were a couple that Drew's never seen, and there's a couple that I've never seen.
Cool.
So that's been really cool for me to actually see it in context, chronologically. So we've
yeah.
seen, we have a lot of insight now into the Disney princess as a social icon.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of insight into animation style and story choices that they've made over the years. We have a lot to say about the genre alterations. Like, some of them are very funny and some of them are very not funny.
Yeah.
And how does that work? And where's the balance? And, you know, just overall, like, their design choices and all sorts of, like, different variants. So what we do is we sit down to watch the movie and we prepare, we sort of discuss the facts, what we call the facts, which is, like, who's in the movie, when was the movie made, what was going on at the time, was the company about to go bankrupt, which for the most part was yes.
Oh,
okay. you know, what was going on in the world at the time, why this movie, why right now, things like that, and then, like, fun little anecdotes about the making of the film. And then after we've discussed the facts, we watch the movie, and we talk along with the movie. And so we record our discussion, and we record our commentary, and that audio has been available to my patrons on Patreon, as sort of, like, an MST3K of Disney. Where you can sync up your movie with us talking over it.
That's
and it's
really cool.
it's been really, really fun. And we invite special guests on to watch the movie with us, and we kind of riff the movie a little bit and, like, talk about more of the stuff. Like, something will happen in the movie and we'll be like, that's interesting because I read that blah, 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 blah. So it's kind of like pop-up video also where we get those facts in there. And so it's been really fun and super eye-opening. And as a result, Drew and I have just this wealth of knowledge that is, like, not useful for everyday life, but super interesting to us, and we love talking about it. So every time something new comes up about Disney, or, like, the remakes, the live-action remakes that are happening,
yeah,
and, like,
yeah.
the sequels that are happening and whatnot, people are like, hey, did you see this? And we're like, yes, we have a lot of thoughts about that. So what's really going... So, like, it's just been really, really cool, and a really interesting way for us to, like, explore our love for that Disney culture, and for us to try to figure out why it's been so successful and why we're all so personally rooted in that. And to answer that question unspokenly, I think our age bracket is super rooted in Disney culture, because of the Disney Renaissance. So the Disney history is divided up into ages. There's the Golden Age, the Silver Age, or the Golden Age, the War Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Dark Age, the Renaissance, the Post-Renaissance, the Revival, and the Experimental.
Fascinating.
I don't know if that's in the right order. That's not the point.
But that's, okay.
So everything leading up to the Disney Renaissance, the company was constantly in and out of about to being bankrupt. They didn't know if something was even going to get made. And then Walt dies, and everyone's like, oh my gosh, is this company going to fold? Who's going to lead us? What do we do? You know, we've got all this stuff we're working on. Can we even afford to make it or, you know, produce it? And then the Disney Renaissance happens, starting with The Little Mermaid.
Okay.
Which is right around the time we all got born.
Yeah.
Yep.
Started getting born in our age bracket, right around that time. So the Little Mermaid changed so much, both for animation and for, like, us as an age bracket.
Yeah.
And then it goes Little Mermaid, oh my gosh, Little Mermaid, Beauty, no, Little Mermaid, Rescuers Down Under, Beauty and the Beast,
oh.
Aladdin,
yeah,
Lion King, Pocahontas, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Mulan, Hercules, Mulan, Tarzan. That whole spectrum, which, shout out to the 90s kids.
Yeah.
Is like, I mean, those are the big, big guns.
And that
for
was
Disney,
in,
right?
That was just within 10 years.
Yes.
It's so
because,
interesting to,
yeah.
to me because I, in my brain, would cut that age off earlier, and I think it's because I'm older. I'm 30,
sure.
So I'm 86. So to me, Pocahontas was the last one. And then you're talking about all these movies, I'm like, I didn't even see those.
Yeah, no, but exactly.
Which is so funny.
The real spark there is Little Mermaid, Beauty
yeah.
and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King. Those
yeah.
four are like the building blocks of our childhood.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that's true. And that's relevant to me, too.
Yeah,
so.
And you can ask my mom about this. Every day when I was like a very small child, I watched The Little Mermaid every day. My dad knew all of the words to Les Poissons, and
yes.
he would sing them with great relish, and, like, just...
See, my funny Little Mermaid story is I was terrified of Ursula, and
she's
it was on... I had to leave the Blockbuster video we were in because it was on the screen and I was scared. Of course, Ursula is my favorite Disney character now,
oh, yes,
so
yes.
I've made my fears into my best friends.
Yeah.
of course. But so that's not my tragic Little Mermaid story.
Oh my god. We clearly had different experiences with that film.
Yeah.
But I would walk around the house singing Aladdin.
Good.
Prince Ali.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. But those four are really the building blocks of our childhood, and that's what we remember. We remember compulsively watching them on VHS
oh,
until
yeah.
the VHS broke, dressing up as them for Halloween,
mm-hmm.
you know, being them in the talent shows in elementary school or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where our brains were as kids. And so even though we've all grown up and, you know, done different things and gone into different areas, like, you could walk into any office or store and start singing Part of Your World or, I don't know, Friend Like Me
mm-hmm.
or There Goes the Baker with His Tray Like Always. And people will be like, bonjour, you know, like, because that's part of who we are now
yeah.
culturally.
Oh, it's so true.
So it's been super interesting watching everything up to the Renaissance. We're currently in the Renaissance. The most recent post I posted on Tuesday, actually,
mm-hmm.
was the Lion King post. So that just went live on the blog.
Oh, cool. Yeah,
so,
I was going to ask for you, but
mm-hmm.
zero.
And so, but we've got two more in the bank that I'm editing now, and then the
mm-hmm.
next one I'm going to watch is Hercules, which is my favorite Disney movie of all time, now only surpassed by Zootopia.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
yeah,
so
because
I'm, like,
you and Drew,
excited.
Like, cosplay as, or is it Disney bounding?
So, good question.
Ah.
Ding, ding, ding. Cosplay, excuse me. Cosplay is when you dress exactly like the character.
Okay.
Or the best representation that you can. Disney bounding is when you take the color palette of the character and different elements of what that character is or looks like, and you reinterpret it in a stylish, fashionable way.
I did not
whoa,
know that.
Whoa, we learned something.
See, what I thought Disney bounding was just cosplaying specifically Disney.
Right. Which is
true.
The idea behind
yeah.
it, but in a stylish way.
That's cool.
fascinating.
So that was invented by Leslie Kay, who is a super fan of Disney from Toronto, I believe. Maybe
okay.
It's Ontario. Canada, I'm not sure.
Oh, Canada.
And she's fantastic. So she invented this a number of years ago just as a way to get herself really hyped up about going to the parks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm going to dress like Marie from the Aristocats, or I'm going to dress like the genie today. And,
yeah.
You know, just taking those color palettes, which are so bright and so iconic for each of the characters.
Yeah.
And then interpreting that into your outfit to, like, go to the parks in. Since they don't allow adults to come in costume to the parks.
Oh.
I don't know if you knew that. So kids can come dressed as their favorite characters because they're children. If an adult walks into the park in a full Belle costume, they will be asked to leave. Because
copyright.
And the actors who are friends with the characters at the Disney parks are very carefully trained and carefully selected and vetted, and, like, you know, they work for the company. They're going to uphold the company standards, and it's a safety thing.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. You don't want to confuse this random adult with one of the actors.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So at Disney, it's a big no-no for adults to wear costumes. They only allow full costumes on Halloween at Disney, at Mickey's Not-So-Scary Halloween Party.
Okay.
Disney bounding is a way to get dressed up and, you know, get out there and be social and show your love for your favorite characters while still following the rules of being in the parks.
Okay.
That's really cool.
Yeah,
yeah.
It is. That's so interesting.
It's really fun. I love doing that. But yeah, no, Drew and I did cosplay Nick and Judy from Zootopia for last C2E2.
And it was super cute.
Thank you.
Yeah. It was very, very cute.
My favorite are the ones where I'm, like, smiling at the camera with my hands on my hips and Drew's, like, looking at his phone.
Yeah.
Because that's totally what Nick does in the movie.
Yeah. No, I saw that and was just like, that's the cutest damn thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And you even take it a step further because you're getting more into photography now.
Yeah. I bought a nice camera.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for several reasons. One, I wanted to start doing videos for the blog and for Disney Odyssey and stuff. And we have. We have a couple videos up on YouTube of us talking about Disney stuff and short bursts, which is hard because we could just keep talking. but I also was inspired by the photography from the Bristol Renaissance Fair, where I work, during the summers and perform there. Bristol is a beautiful, lively, you know, unusual place with a lot of things going on at any given moment. It's a wonderful place for amateur photographers to go and, like, get their feet wet with, like, live action stuff that's completely unpredictable and uncontrollable and get into that sort of photographical genre. And as a result of being a performer there for the last 5 years, I have had the honor of being photographed many times by a number of very, very talented amateur photographers and some professional ones.
Mm-hmm.
and they are the most generous and loving people that, you know, anybody could ask for. I was inspired by what they do, and it made me want to get a camera and kind of, like, try it out.
Cool.
But I was not... I wasn't, like, ready to go sign up for a photography class. I kind of wanted to just mess around with it and see what happened.
Yeah.
So what I ended up doing, some of the Bristol community folks do is we'll get an idea in our heads for a photo shoot, because, you know, we all kind of like playing model now.
Right.
So someone will be like, I want to do a shoot inspired by Robin Hood, or I want to do a shoot inspired by Alphonse Mucha, or I want to do a shoot, you know, based on the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse or whatever. And then they'll, like, tag a photographer and they'll be like, yeah, let's do it. And they go and they do their own costumes and makeup and hair, and then they go out into the wild somewhere and do a cool photo shoot. And then it goes up on Facebook and everyone goes, oh, that's so cool. Why did they invite me? Oh my gosh, I love that picture. And then it kind of, like, perpetuates itself. So the photographers end up getting a lot of experience, and we get experience playing model and, like, designing something. And so I did a couple things. And it inspired me to want to do something myself when I got my camera. And so I got four people together, and I said, hey, you guys like Disney, I like Disney. Do you want to Disney bound as sort of, like, vintage retro Disney princesses and have a picnic and let me take pictures of it? And they were like, Yeah. Yeah, we do. So I was very lucky to have my first photo shoot be what I called a perfectly magical picnic.
Mm-hmm.
And it has Aurora, Snow White, Ariel, and
Belle
in it. Sort of the four big
yeah.
princesses. And it was super fun and super casual, and we had a really good time. And people went crazy about it, and I was like, let's do another one. And they were like, let's do another one! And so we did, and the second one was called A Perfectly Magical Day at the Zoo, and it was in October, and we went to the Lincoln Park Zoo, and shocked the heck out of some kids who were like, oh my gosh, Ariel! No! And we were like, yes, it is us. Nice to see you. And that's when I joined in the fun as Minnie Mouse, just to have some fun, put some ears on and go out.
Yeah,
right. And that was really fun. And then in December we did one where Aurora, Belle, and Ariel are baking Christmas cookies to sort of do the holiday thing. And what I did is on my Facebook is I released a couple of pictures every day as like an advent calendar kind of thing.
That's fun. Okay.
Yeah. And then we did one just recently, which was kind of our first big shoot, which was a perfectly villainous gathering.
Ooh.
And it was a bunch of the Disney villains that got together in a very stylish film noir bar called Barrel House Flat is what it's called, and it's on Lincoln.
Cool.
Yeah, it was super fun.
And actually, one of a member of the opera community was in that.
Yes.
Andrea...
Andrea Jones.
Because
she was, she's an opera on tap,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
which is an organization that Daniel co-runs.
Right.
And, I've been meaning to talk to her, like, go up to her and be like, hey, so you know,
it'll blow our minds.
You know my friend Allie. Huh? I'm waiting for the right moment to do that.
To drop that bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm very excited
I love
about
Andrea.
It.
She's great. She was in A Klingon Christmas Carol with me and Drew.
Oh, okay.
This past December, so she's great. And I was like, I need you to be in this shoot. Come be in the shoot immediately.
Well, and her photos.
She's stunning.
She's Cruella.
She's Cruella.
Oh,
perfect.
My. She kills it.
Yeah,
oh, I'll
she
look
does.
Up later.
Oh, it was, she, I mean, everybody who was at the villain shoot, honestly, nailed it beyond my wildest dreams. I had a very specific image in my head of what I wanted and who I wanted and how I wanted it all to look, but I let them pick their own outfits and I let them do their hair.
Yeah.
Amber, who plays Belle in the other shoots, is a wig stylist at
Drury Lane.
Oh, okay.
She's my former roommate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So Amber came and did everybody's hair and styled the wigs and did this whole thing, and it was unbelievable how it came together in the moment and how everything happened. And my dear friend Alan, who is one of the Bristol photographers, and also one of my Patreon patrons, because he's a big old Disney nerd, he came and did the photo shoot with us so that we were two photographers, and I got to kind of learn from Alan how to do stuff on the camera.
How great.
Like, we got to bounce off each other and do all this stuff, and it was just amazing. It was so cool, and it was really cool to see something so specific in my head actually happen in a perfect way because everybody came together at the right moment.
Satisfying.
Yeah, it was really satisfying. And the pictures are just gold. Like,
so
absolute gold.
No, and whenever I see them, and I was seeing all of the Disney baking stuff, because that was... At first, I was seeing them, and I was like, that... place looks really familiar, and then I was like, oh man, that's my old kitchen.
Yep. It is your old kitchen.
And actually, so I briefly just want to talk about that apartment as just a creative hub.
Mm. Yes.
Because so when I lived there, when I moved to Chicago August of 2015, I did not when I was thinking about moving to
mm-hmm.
Chicago in, like, May of 2015, I had no roommate lined up.
Mm-hmm.
So I shot Allie a message and asked her if she knew of anybody looking for a roommate. She got me in touch with Greg Williamson and Amber Woodkey, who are both Renaissance Fair performers. And so... I moved in August after I did a young artist program, actually with Josh,
oh,
in
yeah.
Pittsburgh. And Greg is the director of the Danse Macabre for the Bristol Renaissance Fair.
Yes, he is.
And Amber is a former performer, but she was a fairy. What's that guild called?
The Fantasticals.
The Fantasticals. Yes. But she's also, like you said, a wig and costume designer, and she was constantly, like, making her own costumes. Like,
she's insane.
She sewed her own bell costume
and
for
she sewed,
that
like,
first,
three more.
Yeah.
Like,
well, because she has that blue one, and then she had the yellow one. And we, like, it's a two-story apartment, and Amber and I were in the basement part of it, and so I would walk out of my room, and she would be, like, sewing. And I would be like, oh, what are you making? She's like, oh, you know, I'm just making, like, a 1940s-inspired bell costume. And then I would go upstairs, and I would see a big pot on the stove with something boiling, and I would ask Greg, like, oh, are you making soup? And he's like, no, I'm boiling bones for costumes for the Danse Macabre troupe. And I was like, oh,
I kind of threw you to the wolves, didn't I?
I was there for it.
Yeah, I feel like it's perfect for you.
Like,
that's
I was,
fine.
Like, I feel like, I don't know, I attract intense people, and I feel like, I feel like
a panda. I was like, she could probably handle it.
Yeah.
She'll be fine.
Oh, and I was great. Yeah. I mean, like, literally the only reason I moved out is that I wanted to move in with Daniel.
Right.
Otherwise, I was planning on re-upping, because sweet
it's
apartment.
It's a nice location.
It's a nice location. They are wonderful people.
Great people.
And actually, so, and I'm actually, like, planning on, like, asking them for help with a couple things, because I'm involved with this, opera, that, by a composer named Ross Cree, and it's a steampunk opera, and one of the characters is, the daughter of the devil.
Oh.
She's the daughter of Pan. And so she has horns.
Yeah.
And I am gonna ask Greg to help me figure out how to make horns for her.
Cool. Yeah, Greg's an incredible resource for props. Like
yeah.
That. He
well,
really is.
He built a dragon
he
puppet.
Did.
A full size dragon.
Like a 12-person dragon.
Oh
puppet.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Like and because he's an engineer, and his concentration in engineering is wood. And so he can, like, carve anything.
That's
amazing.
Genius.
Yeah. It was such a cool environment to land in when I first got here. Because it was just, like, these people. Because I, as a performer, I interpret.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived with two people who created.
That's really cool.
And it was such.
Sure.
Such a different vibe. And I was, like, I would be, like, in my room. And it was, and I think it was, like, I don't want to speak for them, but I think it was cool for them.
Yeah.
Because I would be in my room, like, practicing scales and stuff like that and working on my rep, and I would go upstairs and I would see that, like, Greg had friends over or something,
yeah.
And I would come up and they'd be like, hey, I heard you singing and you were, like, really good.
Which was really,
yeah. I was like, thank you so much, that's awesome. And, no, it was just a...
That's really nice.
It was a cool roommate situation.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, thank you for that.
You are welcome.
Since we're talking about Ren Faire performers, let's talk a little bit about Faire.
For sure.
How did you get involved?
I joined the Bristol Renaissance Faire cast in 2012. The year before that, a friend of mine, Emily Bates, had auditioned for the Faire as just one of her many just-out-of-college auditions.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
Shot in the dark. Don't know anything about it. And she got cast, and she joined the cast, and it changed her life a little bit, I think. Because she came back, and we were like, what are you doing this summer? And
yeah.
She was like, I'm doing the Ren Faire. You guys have to be there. I can't believe you've never gone there. It's, like, out of your brains. You have to go,
meaning
our group of friends. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I lived in Milwaukee, and I never went to Bristol. And I don't know how that happened. But it did. And I was kind of like, okay. So we went, and we visited her closing weekend of 2011. And it blew my mind. It completely blew my mind. And I thought, okay, I'm going to audition next year. So I auditioned. And at my audition, it was the scariest audition I've ever been to because there were 20 people in the room. 20 directors in the room.
Oh, yeah, those are hard.
And
I've been to that.
I had no idea really what I was getting into. But they were so kind and so excited about meeting who I was that it didn't feel like an audition after I had performed.
Good.
And I remember I did a monologue from King John.
Okay.
Shakespeare's King John as the bastard, because I played him senior year. And I took out my ukulele and I performed Creep by Radiohead.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they, like, a couple of the guys, like, threw their chairs. They were so excited. And so that was really flattering. And then I got cast, and I ended up joining a Commedia dell'arte troupe called At Your Service. And we played servants, Commedia servants, who were looking for work, basically. That was the joke. And so we did all kinds of weird stuff, and I brought my ukulele, and that was, like, I had just taught myself one song so that I could go to the audition with a song. And then they were like, great, so you're gonna play ukulele, and we're gonna write songs. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. I don't know anything about music theory. I can't write songs. I don't know how. And they were like, oh, that's not the point. That's not the point. And Bristol is this magical place where people who don't know what they're capable of can go and discover that, if they're receptive to that. And what I ended up doing at Bristol was it kind of broke me open in a huge way and helped me figure out who I already was,
yeah,
kind of deep down. I learned how to talk to people. Mm-hmm. I learned real improv. I learned a ton about a really interesting period in history. I learned how to write dumb songs on my ukulele, which mm-hmm. I still do.
That's great.
I am available for birthdays, bat mitzvahs, Christmas presents, engagements, and funerals.
I've played ukulele at a wedding before.
That makes a lot of sense.
And it was very fun.
That sounds fun.
They wanted the recessional to be your lipstick stains on the front lobe of your left side. Hey, soul sister.
Yeah.
Which was cool.
Yeah. So it made me do a bunch of things that I knew I couldn't do. It made me do those things. And then
That's good.
Which is crazy. And that's really all you can ask for from an artistic endeavor show, right?
Yeah.
So I did Commedia dell'arte with At Your Service for 3 years. My third year, I was the director of the troupe.
Amazing.
And I played several different Commedia stock characters during that time. And then that third year, I thought, okay, I would like a new challenge. I'm not ready to leave Bristol, but I want a new challenge. And I stepped down as director, and my very dear, wonderful human being, best friend, Claire Hart, took over as director, and she's still directing it now. And I stepped out, and I joined the Guild of St. George, which is the court of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth I.
Oh, okay.
And at Bristol, the year is 1574, approximately. And it is the 16th year of Her Majesty's reign. And so I wanted to seize an opportunity to do some history, to do some living history reenactment, as well as build on all of those skills I've already gotten into. So I portray Mistress Bess Throckmorton at Her Majesty's court, former maid of honor, now just a lady of the court.
Yeah.
But what I've been told recently is that Bess, as I play her, is kind of like Beatrice and Much Ado About Nothing, but at court. Like, I just say whatever I want, to whoever I want, apologize profusely, and like skittle away. Like, and people are like, don't mess with her. That's Throckmorton. Don't mess with Throckmorton, because she will tear you apart with her wit.
That's amazing.
And so we have a good time. And I love the living history. I love the pomp and the circumstance. I love wearing a 10-layer Elizabethan gown in the middle of August. And by love, I mean it's really hard some days, but once you're in it, you're in it, and you just ride it out.
That's it.
But it's an amazing opportunity to continue to give to people in a very direct environment. And the only thing, honestly, the only thing more magical than Bristol is Disney World.
Right.
Or Disneyland. Nowhere else can you go. And immediately, everyone who is a member of that cast is there to welcome you, to learn about who you are, to celebrate you for being here, to get you the best food, the best wine, the best entertainment, and, like, give you the best day of your life when you walk through the gates. And it's so much fun, and I love doing it, and it's a huge lesson. And if you have a chance to go, go. If you have a chance to join the cast and learn what we do, do it, because it will change the way you handle the rest of your art, honestly.
That's awesome.
I know, I'm feeling inspired.
So with that,
yeah.
We are at time, but I want to give you a minute to just hard plug anything and everything you have going on.
Absolutely.
So, go.
Okay, so, you can find me on my blog at dreamstobecome.com. You can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/authorgrauer, G-R-A-U-E-R. The blog will have links to pretty much everything else, so if you poke around, you'll probably find it. But I'm also on Patreon, patreon.com/AllisonGrauer, AllisonGrauer. The Patreon is a great way to, if you don't already know, is a great way to support artists doing things that they love and producing things for you to enjoy and share with other people. The Patreon is kind of what helped me get my camera. It's what helps me pay for my blog and for the podcasting equipment that I have and the podcasting space that I have purchased. I am finally on podbean.com and I am producing, I'm releasing the back stock of Disney Odyssey commentary audio.
Oh,
so it's
cool.
Going to be public now, gradually. I'm making
okay,
that public.
Okay, yeah.
The other things we do on the blog are what we call the Night's Rewatch, where Drew and I are rewatching Game of Thrones episodes in chronological order, because we're not going to do it any other way.
No.
And it'd be weird to watch it, like, out of order.
Like, who does that?
Not Game of Thrones.
So we're rewatching Game of Thrones, because I've only ever seen every episode once.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do kind of the Disney Odyssey thing, but in a more mature environment.
Right, of course.
So the Night's Rewatch is a lot of fun. There's the Disney Odyssey. Occasionally I do other weird random blog posts. The other things, you can find the Perfectly Magical photo shoots at facebook.com/perfectlymagicaladventures. And all of those photos are up there, and you can check it out and see what's coming up next. I have two more shoots coming up, one this month and one next month, and I'm very excited. I just started releasing a new improv podcast, improv fiction podcast thing that is called D&D 20 Public Radio.
Okay.
And it's part NPR, part D&D, and part Waiting for Guffman.
I'm so into this.
It's basically live improv interviews with the members of the All Orc and Goblin Community Theater Project in Central Drassmore.
Okay.
I play Eleanor Stonefield, who's the correspondent who's interviewing them. And it's very funny. Like, I would strongly suggest checking that out because it's very funny. The first episode is out on Podbean, and so it's dreamstobecome.podbean.com. Also links on the blog. Everything is linked, so you can't really miss it.
Yeah. So basically just, like, go to aforementioned websites, poke around.
Yeah.
And you'll find the rest of it.
And have,
yeah.
Like, I'd say, honestly, dedicate an afternoon, it sounds like. To
I
want
so much.
Yeah.
There's so, so much on there. And
nice.
I'm constantly doing new stuff. I try to do, like, 2 Disney Odyssey posts a month.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And spread them out. I try to spread everything out so it's, like, a constant rotation of fun, weird stuff.
Cool.
I love it.
So, yeah. Check it out.
Awesome.
And my novel, again, is called On the Isle of Sound and Wonder. You can get it on Amazon or you can order it at Barnes & Noble.
Perfect.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah,
this
thank
has
you.
Been a blast.
Thank
it's
you
been
guys.
Awesome to see you.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Right?
And so let's wrap things up. So you can find us on Facebook at Scoppy Magazine. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Scoppy Mag. Subscribe to us on iTunes at Scoppy Mag. Generally, what we've been doing is posting episodes late at night and then advertising them on our Facebook in the morning.
Hmm.
So if you are a subscriber, you know about it before we post about it.
Right.
So it is to your advantage to do that so that you can listen to something on your commute to work.
Yeah.
And then, sorry, I'm just like remembering all the things that Daniel says and now I'm going to say my piece. I just want to emphasize the importance of donations.
Yes.
As you heard, we have noisy heaters and noisy cats. And while new audio equipment will not silence our cats, it will make it easier to shut out the sound of our noisy heaters. So if you head to scoppymag.com and you go to the About section, you can be a subscriber or you can do a one-time donation. If you are a subscriber, we'll give you a shout-out on the show. If you do a one-time donation, we will send you a handwritten thank you note.
Ooh.
In the mail.
Ooh, the mail.
Yes.
Give a little, give a lot, and if you can't give, listen, participate, share.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
And,
all right. I'm going to make Maureen do all the work, and I'll take Daniel's sign off.
Yeah.
So, you know, go out there and make something.
Yep.